This is Robert Magidoff speaking from Moscow. The situation in the south continues grim and threatening, although the Red Army struck back in two vital battle zones and halted the German advance, at least for the time being. One of these is Klitskaya, in the Don Elbow area, where a Russian retreat was announced last night. The Red Army, however, abruptly stopped its withdrawal and launched a powerful tank attack, inflicting heavy losses. This action came in good time, for a German breakthrough here would have made Stalingrad a besieged city. An even more striking comeback was achieved at Kushchevskaya on the Rostov-Baku railway. Here, a daring Cossack raid behind enemy lines just on the eve of a planned major German attack cost the enemy 3,000 lives. The Cossacks pursued German infantrymen for about 2 miles, cutting them off from the tanks all ready for action. The tanks crawled out of their well-camouflaged nests to follow the fleeing infantry and thus expose themselves to the deadly fire of Russian guns. In the other two vital sectors in the south, at Semlyanskaya and Belaya Glina, the Soviet troops were forced to retreat to new positions. More and more German parachutists are being dropped from the skies behind Soviet lines in the south. They usually come in groups of 150 Tommy gunners equipped with heavy machine guns, trench mortars, and even baby tanks. These troops land as a rule in the vicinity of railway stations and road junctions and immediately go for the stations or the settlement nearest to the road. The measures adopted against these intruders from the skies include the creation of destroyer battalions among the civilians in every settlement that might be threatened by paratroops. Goodbye from Moscow.
Events in our nation's capital are covered for us by Richard Harkness of the Philadelphia Inquirer. For this report, we take you now to the newsroom in Washington.
The prospect for nationwide gasoline rationing is a real one this morning. For if the government doesn't act, if it doesn't act soon to restrict civilian driving all over the country, the War Production Board sees a complete breakdown in automobile transportation by next March. These officials say that by next March, the average American tire will be worn down to a point where it will be good for only 4,000 more miles, and there'll be no rubber for recaps or retreads. Other decisions are piling up on the president's desk today. He promises to announce by tomorrow or Friday his verdict on the 8 German saboteurs. Also, he may have to settle once and for all the government's policy regarding wage raises during this war boom. For Mr. Roosevelt's War Labor Board is opening hearings today on the demands of 61,000 textile workers for more pay. The workers want raises ranging from 7.5 to 10 cents an hour in the South. Opponents of the raise claim that it will bring inflation closer. But Mr. Roosevelt is taking his work as the nation's war leader in his stride. At his news conference yesterday, he appeared physically fit. The president was wearing a white cotton shirt. By the time newspaper and radio correspondents jammed into his room, Mr. Roosevelt had pulled his necktie loose so he could unbutton his collar, just like any other working man. The president sharply criticized profiteers who have created a black market in steel to evade government price ceilings. He said they ought to be in jail. Mr. Roosevelt had hardly spoken when two government agencies, the War Production Board and the Office of Price Administration, opened investigations. The president launched this double-barreled probe after an official of the Higgins Shipyard in New Orleans charged that there was a well-organized black steel market in existence, a black steel market supplied with steel from a nationwide string of warehouses. There's good news for taxpayers today. A poll of the Senate Finance Committee shows that a majority of members favor amending the House tax bill to permit family heads to make deductions for payments on insurance or for retirement of mortgages or old debts. Senator Prentice Brown of Michigan comes up with another idea to ease the tax burden. He advocates letting family heads take $400 a year exemptions for sons and daughters attending college. The way the law stands now, a father can take that deduction only as long as his son or daughter is less than 18 years old. And Brown also would prevent deductions for doctor bills or for hospital expenses. And there's good news, too, from the Southwest Pacific. In the battles of Midway and Coral Sea, American Navy fighters shot down between 54 and 72 Japanese. We lost only 4. And that's all from Washington.
From our newsroom in New York, from Chongqing, Lieutenant General Joseph Stilwell's headquarters has more good news about the American Army flyers in China. Our bombers yesterday made a successful raid on Japanese installations near Hankou, the inland center of the Yangtze River. American bombardiers hit wharves, warehouses, and shipping. And when Japanese warplanes attacked the town of Kuilin, 250 miles northwest of Canton this morning, the enemy is believed to have lost three aircraft. American fighters got two, and ground fire the third one. And now we turn across the nation and the Pacific for a summary of developments in the Southwest Pacific Theater of War. We take you now to Martin Agronsky, somewhere in Australia.
This is Martin Agronsky, somewhere in Australia. I with me tonight Lieutenant Clifton H. Troxell of Cleveland, Ohio, a pursuit pilot of the U.S. Army Air Corps. Troxell is 25, a reserve officer, and is on leave from a prolonged period of active service at one of our most advanced air bases. He's one of the men who's really fighting your war against the Jap out here. Lieutenant, how many times have you been in combat against the Jap?
Well, I guess I went out on patrol looking for them about 40 times. I forgot how many times we hit them. There was plenty.
Have you shot down any Japs, Lieutenant?
I've got farther for them so far. No official confirmation yet.
What do you think of the Jap fighters?
The pilots are good, very good. But they've got a plane that anybody could be good at.
Lieutenant, can you think of any combat to illustrate that point?
I sure can. A few weeks ago, seven of us, in P-39, were on an escort mission. We ran into about 22 Zeros. The Japs are about the same level we were flying, about 12,000 feet. We went straight in for an attack. Pull forward formation, firing everything we had. I think our first burst hit a couple of them and broke up their formation. The fight scattered out of the sky then. My buddy, Lieutenant Lynch, and I stuck together and went for altitude to get a look around. We were getting low on petrol and ammunition and had decided to return home. And we sighted 3 Zeros about 6,000 feet below us. We peeled off for a pale attack. They didn't seem to spot us, but we both got in a good long burst as we came into range. And they started into a terrific climb that usually saved us.
Wait a minute, Lieutenant. What do you mean, save them?
Well, I'd like to have a nickel for every time we've had them box clean in our sight and seen them climb right away from us.
Do you think you dropped those two, though?
Yes, I saw both of them diving out of control into the trees.
How about the third one, Lieutenant?
Well, he almost got me.
What happened?
Well, when I came out of my attack, I looked around and found this third Zero sitting on my tail, almost within firing range. I was out of ammunition, and so went flat out, just above the trees. He hung right on to me for a good 8 minutes, and I thought I'd never lose him. Luckily, I found some low cloud and got away in that.
Lieutenant Troxell, that seems to show that the Jap is putting up a pretty good fight on this front.
Well, they're not exactly clay pigeons, but we're still staying on top of them. And as long as they'll keep sending the stuff out from home, we'll continue to stay on top of them.
Thank you, Lieutenant. This is Martin Agronsky, signing off now from somewhere in Australia.
Our next on-the-spot report comes to us from Cairo and Grant Parr.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. Artillery boomed out across whitey desert sands and limestone ridges on the Alamein front yesterday. And overhead, Royal Air Force fighters roared back and forth, patrolling. But the eight-day-old period of tactical inactivity showed no signs of breaking. The weather was good. That is, there was nothing to impede the burning rays of the desert sun, and the sky was still as blue as the crystal waters of the Mediterranean. Lucky troops along the coast dived into cool breakers which rolled up on white sand table-like beaches. The artillery exchange was brisk and kept the opposing forces behind ridges and in foot trenches on parts of the northern and central sectors. During the day, two Messerschmitt single-seaters came twisting down from dogfights in frontline skies. They crashed. But all this was only part of a normal Blitzkrieg. In the slip trenches, men waited impatiently or nervously, as temperament dictated, for the war to begin again. They wondered when Rommel would consider himself strong enough to attack, or when they themselves would get the order. They watched the British light bombers, fighter bombers, fighters, drumming westward and blessed their mission. For there was not a man so dull as to realize the vital necessity of busting around those supply lines and his concentration. The Allied air forces didn't do a bad job against Axis shipping. After sinking or badly damaging four enemy supply lighters Monday, Australian and RAF fighter pilots got four more yesterday, a total of eight in 2 days. Monday, they hit and at least slightly damaged two others. Heavy bombers of the United States Army Air Forces attacked three large Axis merchant ships in the eastern Mediterranean, hit one ship, and landed bombs so close to others that they may have been damaged. During raids on Tobruk, British bombers hit a ship, set off a series of explosions, after which the vessel burned so fiercely that the blaze was visible 50 miles. Another ship was also set afire in the center of the harbor. This made nine full-sized Axis vessels sunk or badly damaged by air attack within 10 days. The motor lighters raided yesterday were attacked near Saloon by British fighters, which went in under a German fighter escort. Three fixed barges were set on fire, one by an American pilot serving in the RAF. A fourth lighter, hit near Bardia, appeared later to be sinking. I now return you to New York.
Our final overseas report this morning comes to us from the British capital. We take you now to London and John McVane.
This is London. RAF bombers attacked objectives in the industrial Ruhr region of Germany last night. Fighters raided railroads and other targets in occupied territory. A bomber and a fighter are missing. The Germans lost six bombers over here last night in attacks on South and Southwest England and Southern Wales. Damage was slight and there were few casualties. The King announced today that Sunday, September 3rd, the third anniversary of Britain's declaration of war on Germany, will be a national day of prayer. The British are shocked and disturbed by the revelation of Gandhi's readiness to negotiate with the Japanese and Pandit Nehru's quoted statement that Gandhi's attitude is influenced by his belief in an Axis victory. People who keep in touch with the Indian situation here have tended to regard Gandhi as either an astute, hard-boiled politician or as a saintly character deserving the highest respect. The news from India yesterday doesn't do much to clarify these opinions. Either Gandhi is falling into the understandable error of the French politicians who thought they could negotiate with the Germans to establish their own position in France, or else his thought processes are working in an unworldly plane that has no connection at all with reality. The thought that after British and American troops left India, Gandhi would go to Tokyo to negotiate with the toughest race of imperialists since Attila seems ludicrous to those Britishers who sincerely wish India well and had hoped for responsible Indian self-government. The Liberal News Chronicle says Gandhi has emerged as India's Archipisa, and the paper compares his projected trip to Tokyo with Neville Chamberlain's trip to Munich. Men of the British services who go to America come home singing the praises of American hospitality. It would be wrong to think that that same sort of hospitality isn't being extended to men of the American forces in Britain. Thousands of British men and women have offered a welcome in their homes to American troops for a day, a weekend, or as long as they can get leave. But because of red tape, these thousands of letters are lying useless in the files of the organizations that should provide the link between the American Army and the British people. There's growing disappointment among the British who, whether they live in a big country house or in a few rooms in the back street of an industrial city, have spontaneously offered to share their homes with the American boys. The fault doesn't lie with the Army authorities, but with officials of these linking organizations who haven't taken the trouble to brush away the red tape and give Anglo-American friendship its best chance to flourish. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And so ends another of NBC's morning roundups of the news of the world. Today we heard from Robert Magadoff, Richard Harkness, Martin Agronsky, Grant Parr, and John McVane. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.